The following is a class on the Srimad Bhagavatam, 2nd Canto, Chapter 1, Text Number 14, given by Srila Arinda Sarupdas on April 27, 1992, in Potomac.
Reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 4, The Process of Creation. This morning, text number 14. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto he who is the associate of the members of the Yadu dynasty, and who is always a problem for the non-devotees. He is the supreme enjoyer of both the material and the spiritual worlds, yet he enjoys his own abode in the spiritual sky. There is no one equal to him because his transcendental opulence is immeasurable. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Let's pay attention. This goes on for 2.5 pages. There are two sides of the transcendental manifestation of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. For the pure devotees, he is the constant companion, as in the case of his becoming one of the family members of the Yadu dynasty, or his becoming the friend of Arjuna, or his becoming the associate neighbor of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, as the son of Nanda Yashoda, the friend of Sudama, Sridama, and Maramangala, or the lover of the damsels of Brajabhumi, etc. That is part of his personal feature, of his personal features. And by his impersonal feature, he expands the rays of the Brahma Jyoti, which is limitless and all-pervasive. Part of this all-pervasive Brahma Jyoti, which is compared to the sun's rays, is covered by the darkness of the Mahatattva. And this insignificant part is known as the material world. In this material world, there are innumerable universes, like the one we can experience, and in each of them, there are hundreds of thousands of planets, like the one we are inhabiting. The mundaners are more or less captivated by the unlimited expansion of the rays of the Lord, but the devotees are concerned more with his personal form, from which everything is emanating. Janmadyasya yataha. As the sun rays are concentrated in the sun disk, the Brahma Jyoti is concentrated in Goloka Vrindavan, the topmost spiritual planet in the spiritual sky. The immeasurable spiritual sky is full of spiritual planets named Vaikunthas, far beyond the material sky. The mundaners have insufficient information of even the mundane sky. So what can they think of the spiritual sky? And therefore, the mundaners are always far away from him. Even if, in the future, they are able to manufacture some machine whose speed may be accelerated to the velocity of the wind or the mind, the mundaners will still be unable to imagine reaching the planets in the spiritual sky. So the Lord and his residential abode will always remain a myth or a mysterious problem, but for the devotees, the Lord will always be available as an associate. In the spiritual sky, his opulence is immeasurable. The Lord resides in all the spiritual planets, the innumerable Vaikuntha planets. By expanding his plenary portions along with his liberated devotee associates. But the impersonalists who want to merge in the existence of the Lord are allowed to merge as one of the spiritual sparks of the Brahma Jyoti. They have no qualifications for becoming associates of the Lord, either in the Vaikuntha planets or in the supreme planet, Goloka Vrindavan, described in the Bhagavad Gita as Madhama, and here in this verse at the Swadham of the Lord. This Madhama or Swadhama is described in the Bhagavad Gita 15.6 as followed. Natadbasayate suryo shashanko na pavakaha yadgatva na divartante tadama puramam mama. The Lord Swadham does not require any sunlight or moonlight or electricity for illumination. And that dham or place is supreme, and whoever goes there never comes back to this material world. The Vaikuntha planets and the Goloka Vrindavan planet are all self-illuminating, and the rays scattered by those Swadham of the Lord constitute the existence of the Brahma Jyoti, as further confirmed in the Vedas, like the Mundaka 2210, Katta 2215, and Svetashvatara Upanishad 614. So the same verse appears three different Upanishads. Natatra Suryo Bhatina Chandra Tarakam Nema Vidyutto Bhantikuto Yam Agnihi Tameva Bantam Anubhati Sarvam Tasya Bhasa Sarvam Midam Vibhati. In this Swadham of the Lord, there is no need of sun, moon, or stars for illumination, nor is there need of electricity, so what to speak of ignited lamps. On the other hand, it is because those planets are self-illuminating that all effulgence has become possible, and whatever there is that is dazzling is due to the reflection of that Swadham. One who is dazzled by the effulgence of the impersonal Brahma Jyoti cannot know the personal transcendence. Therefore, in the Ishopanishad 15, it is prayed that the Lord shift his dazzling effulgence so that the devotee can see the real reality. It is spoken thus. Hiranmayena patrena Satyasyapi hitam mukham tattam pushana pavinu satyadharmaya drishtaye. O Lord, you are the maintainer of everything, both material and spiritual, and everything flourishes by your mercy. Your devotional service, or bhakti yoga, is the actual principle of religion, satya dharma, and I am engaged in that service. So kindly protect me by showing your real face. Please, therefore, remove the veil of your Brahma Jyoti rays so that I can see your real form of eternal bliss and knowledge. So the translation again. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto he who is the associate of the members of the Yadu dynasty and who is always a problem for the non-devotees. He is the supreme enjoyer of both the material and spiritual worlds. Yet he enjoys in his own abode in the spiritual sky. There is no one equal to him because his transcendental opulence is immeasurable. So in the beginning of the verse, the Lord is characterized in these two ways. One, Rishabhaya Satvatam, as the associate of the Satvatam, the devotees, here it says particularly members of the Yadu dynasty, is the close associate of the devotees, but Vidura Kashtaya, far away from the mundane wranglers. So here Prabhupada says, Prabhupada says here, there's two features of the Supreme Lord, and he talks about these two, the personal feature and the impersonal. We were also talking about this yesterday. It's a fact that ultimately for the devotees, the personal feature of the Lord is not a problem because they become qualified to be an associate of the Lord. Therefore, when the Lord is there, his abode is there, all his other associates are there, everything is there. It's not that by some speculative process we're going to figure out something about Krishna. We'll just simply have direct association with Krishna by having entrance into his abode, which is very difficult to imagine. The highest thing that people from the material world can imagine is the Brahma Jyoti. Notice what Prabhupada says here. So the Brahma Jyoti is the rays of the spiritual planets. So in the spiritual planets, he says, the Brahma Jyoti is concentrated in Goloka Vrindavan. So you can imagine undifferentiated Brahman. So in Goloka Vrindavan, it's concentrated. Krishna's body, the forms in Goloka Vrindavan, all are made out of concentrated Brahman. So that's where it all comes from. So this is very difficult to imagine. And the people in the material world cannot conceive of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So of course we want to bring them into the association for Krishna, but first of all we have to at least persuade them that this presentation of ours of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, well, at least is reasonable. Because we're saying, here is God, 16-year-old, blue-colored, cowherd boy. This is a very strange idea for most people. And they think, what do they think? All right, oh, a symbol. This is a symbol. They cannot, they always say, especially when I meet scholars or graduates, you don't literally believe that, do you? So they can all understand that it's a symbol and so on. For that kind of thinking, of course, devotional service is impossible. Even for people who are Christians that believe in God, or Jews, or those people, they will say that God is a person, but then they have the notion of person that's not like a person at all. Something else. So we have to be able at least to give people some idea that what we believe in, there's limits to logic. You can show something is reasonable to show it's true is something else again. But so we'll be content with reasonable for now. If you look at what how people think or conceive of God, when they think of something spiritual, they think of something formless. And that's because spirit is very subtle and not perceptible to the senses. If you look at the list of material elements as they're given in, say, Bhagavad Gita, you can start with the grossest and go to the subtlest. You start with earth, then water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego. That's from, look at it this way. You need the first five, of course, the only ones people know about. Of course, when you say earth, water, fire, air, ether, people think that's old-fashioned. So this is what we say, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. That's exactly what it means. Those terms come from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Very smart. Solids. Notice they're in terms of more perceptible. This is what meant by gross. Gross means is more available to all your senses. Earth is grosser than water. Water is grosser than fire. Fire is grosser than air. Air is grosser than space. Space, they don't even think of an element. People think of ether or space as a vacuum. But it's not. I mean, at least according to modern physics, there, scientists talk about space being curved by gravitational waves, and in quantum mechanics there's lots and pages of equations describing what's supposed to be empty space. So it's not nothing. There's something going on there. So you've gone from something that's very perceptible to all your senses. According to Vedic understanding, Earth has the quality of odor, which is missing from water. Water has form, which is missing from water has taste, which is missing from fire, so on. So that you get down to finally space, which only has the quality of sound. And that's as far as they get. Then you go into mind, which is subtler still. And I say that's as far as the material scientists are concerned. That's all they know about. The other part of material nature, mind, intelligence, and false ego, they're still trying to figure out whether it even exists or not. But it's there. They're material elements. But of course, they're harder for them to find out they exist because they're subtler. Subtler means harder to pick up, harder to detect with your senses. So mind is subtler than even space. And even subtler than mind is buddhi. Even subtler than that is ahankara. And then, of course, the subtlest of all, consciousness or spirit. So this way, by going this experiences like this, so people, when they think of spirit, then they think, wow, it's just like not there, you know, it's just, what is it? It's just, they can't conceive of anything like it by their speculative methods. And the general tendency has been, actually, in Western speculation, to think of spirit as mind. That's what they think of. They think of spirit as mind. The Greek word psychic is used both, and Aristotle thought of God, his definition of God was self-thinking thought. There was a being up there which was just pure intelligence or thought. What did he think about? Only himself. He couldn't contemplate anything lower, so he didn't even know that there was a world or anything like that because he was too elevated to notice. So he was like self-thinking thought. That's all. In this way, people... And one time, William James, in a lecture to some Unitarian ministers, was just... wanted a handy definition of God, and he said, we all think of God, he said, as a mental personality. And that's what he said. A mental personality. See, nothing gross. See, even here somebody believes in God as a person, but they think a mental personality. A disembodied mind. And that's what I sort of grew up thinking of God as, a disembodied mind. Of course, it's hard to imagine a disembodied mind, so I kept thinking of a disembodied brain. In my childhood, there was a movie that came out that we all went to see that had these monsters that were these brains with spinal cords attached, and they used to float through the... I don't know, you're probably old enough to remember that movie. They grabbed you and put their spinal cords around you and sucked your blood out, these brains like that. Sort of like that, a cosmic floating brain is the way one sort of thought of God. This mind idea. That's among the personalists. This God is this just pure mind or disembodied mind. Why do they want to say a mental personality? What's this notion of mental personality? Certainly, you don't have it. It's like having a relationship with somebody only by telephone or something. Everybody knows you can communicate much more with somebody when you talk to them face to face, make eye contact, body language, and so many things. What's this just telephone business, you know, long distance? But they think like that, mental personality. They think there's something wrong with the form. You know, that's when this notion, they get all scared about anthropomorphism when they think of form. Now, our contention, of course, that the Supreme has form. Why do we insist on that? Because he's a person. Actually, if you just... See, these are all undefined terms, you know. God is a person. We say Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anytime we say these terms, God, person, form,
Everybody has a different idea in the head. Soul is another one. Those words have to be explained. This is what I mean, because everybody has been have all kinds of ideas. So, when we are, first of all, even when we talk about God, we have to explain what they mean, what we mean. It's a relief. It was a relief to me to see the expression Supreme Personality of Godhead, because I had so many bad associations with the word God that I thought it was, I was pleased that Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's a very precise term. Godhead means the absolute truth. When we talk about Krishna, we're talking about the absolute truth. That is to say, ultimate source of all energies, janmadasyataha. The concept of God by itself just means a controller. There could be, in principle, many gods. And there's no reason in principle there can't be a committee running everything. You could argue there needs to be a chairman, but the concept of God just means controller. But the idea of absolute truth requires that there only be one, the ultimate source of all energies. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about Krishna, that from which everything has emanated. And then the question was, and some people, of course, they'll deny that there is such a thing. That's the first obstacle. They want to think that everything just is, because it is, because it is, because it is, because it is, whatever. Anything, you can see that things come into being. They have causes of why they come into being. The whole world is made up of things that philosophers use the word contingent. Their existence, they exist or they might not exist. They come into being because something makes them come into being, and after a while they go out of being. So if everything in this world is like that, all the articles that we see in the world, they're all contingent beings, then the sum total of all contingent beings is itself contingent. What brought it into existence? Well, it has to be a cause. So some other being brought it into existence. Is that being contingent? Well, yes. So then you have the same problem on another level. You get a whole room full of contingent beings. Then the whole thing is contingent, what that has brought into being. So ultimately, either you come to say there's some being that exists and has always existed and was not into brought in being by anything else, or else you've got to say, well, somewhere along the line, the things just popped into existence for no cause whatsoever. That's what you have to believe. And, in fact, that is what people do believe. That's what science is all about, getting you to believe that. You have to study a lot of science before you can live with that idea, but if you're successful, you will. They have in science the notion of absolute chance. That means that there's additions to reality that have no cause. Things just are the way they are without any cause. And a guy I knew in physics protested, and the professor just says, you'll get used to it. You'll get used to it. So that's one route. You can actually say, you know, you can. This is the problem, you know, with any logical argument. You know, you start with a premise, say, everything has a cause. All contingent things have a cause. And somebody will deny it. And you can always deny a premise. Sometimes if you don't like the conclusion, you can deny the premise as long as you want. So that's the limitation on any logical argument. Say, take the logical argument. Here's the standard form. You know, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, let's not say Socrates. Let's say Kastubha. All men are mortal. Kastubha is a man, therefore Kastubha is mortal. See, so I proved to him that he's going to die. He doesn't like that conclusion. It's upsetting to him, right? So he can say, how do you know all men are mortal? Have you seen all men? What have you seen? He says, taking an argument from Bhagavan. The inside of your mother's womb. You know. That's just your limited experience. There may be many immortal persons, you just don't know about them. And I could be one of them. Or he may agree that all men are mortal, but he denies that Kastubha is a man. Maybe I came from another planet. How do you know? You know? So you can always, if you don't like the conclusion, you can do like this. I once actually literally had a college student tell me that she wasn't going to die. She said she had an inner conviction about this. She said, I've always known I was different. So, anyway, so the problem, this is one of the difficulties with her. You have a perfectly valid argument. So valid argument means if the premises are true, the conclusion is also true. But you can always, if you don't like the conclusion, deny a premise. And that's a limitation. So some people will deny that there is an absolute truth. They really will. The conclusion is so odious to them that they'll deny it. But if we get to the point that somebody will agree that, yes, there has to be an ultimate source of all energies, then we can start talking about what is that source like. And we have these two ideas that are presented here, the impersonal idea and the personal. Now, we say both. The two aspects, actually there's three, Paramatma, Bhagavan, Brahma Jyoti. So we say the absolute truth is a person, personality of Godhead. Godhead means the absolute truth. Krishna is the supreme personality of that absolute truth. Now, what does it mean to say person? Prabhupada gives a definition of person. He says to say God is a person is to say that God has senses. And there's a definition of a person that has senses. And that's a really interesting way to go about defining a person. That's another word. You know, there's a huge literature on the meaning of the word person. Christian theologians really got into it because they have the three persons of the Trinity. So everybody tries to figure out what is the meaning of that word person. They have a Latin word, persona, which literally denotes the masks worn by actors in plays. Those are called persona. In other words, a character or a role, and then they try to figure out some deep meaning. So Prabhupada says person means that the absolute truth has senses. Okay, well, let's understand what a sense is. According to the analysis of the Vedas, we have senses. In fact, 10. Most people think in the West think of 5 senses. But these are just one set of senses, which are called gyan indriya, knowledge acquiring senses. That is to say, the instruments by which we receive information about the world. We have instruments for perceiving light and form, sense of sight, for sound vibration, sense of hearing, sense of taste, sense of touch, and sense of smell. These 5 kinds of instruments. Some of it's localized, like the eyes for the sense of instruments for seeing. For sense of touch, it's spread out all over your body in the form of the skin, and so on. So these are those, then the other set of instruments, we don't think of senses, but they're classified as indriya, senses or instruments for acting back on the world. With the Gyanindriya, the world acts on us, the environment acts on us. And with the others, the karma indriya, the acting senses, we act back on the environment. So that means and senses for manipulating things, karos, hands in Sanskrit, hands. Or maybe, you know, we have pinchers or we have various other devices like that. Instruments for locomotion, for getting around in the world. Instruments for making sound, our tongue and palate for the speech. Or roaring or growling or whatever it is, peeping, whatever it is we do. And then instruments for reproduction and evacuation. So these are the instruments that we have. To be a person means to have instruments. It means, therefore, that there's an environment, and it all the organized array of instruments for the user of those instruments. That's what a body is. So if you say the Absolute is a person, person means has senses, senses implies body or form. So this notion, you know, of a disembodied person or a formless person, that's like a very incomplete notion. It is, in fact, the notion of a ghost who is in a deprived state. He's without his instruments and therefore has to inhabit or possess somebody with a gross form. But God is complete, not a ghost, although has been called the Holy Ghost, is not. So this is, if he's a person, there he's all set with form. And God has a form. The Absolute Truth has form. So one argument that Prabhupada gives, if the Absolute Truth is that from which everything comes, and so many persons here in this world come from the Absolute Truth, then how can the Absolute not be a person? The premise is, you cannot give what you haven't got. That if so much variety, so many people, so many individuals come from the Absolute Truth, then variety and individuality is there in the Absolute Truth. Prabhupada says, we can understand Krishna by studying ourselves. You have to know how to do it, of course. You can make big mistakes in that endeavor. But he said that. We are persons. Krishna is a person. Prabhupada, in one lecture, he said, we see in this world that boys are attracted to girls and girls are attracted to boys. Where does that come from? Janmadasya yataha. It comes from the Absolute Truth. It's there. He also, in another lecture, inquired where the flute-playing propensity came from. We see in human beings who play and blow on musical instruments. He said, it comes from Krishna. Everything has its origin there. There's been a big debate recently on the origins of baseball. It came, actually, the first baseball player, at least the batter, was Balaram, and the pitcher was Dravida Gorilla. As far as I can see, this is the origin of baseball. So all these games and everything, that sporting propensity is there. It comes from the Absolute Truth. You cannot give what you haven't got. Again, you'll run into people that say, yes, you can, you know. But as I said, at a certain point, Prabhupada, there was a morning walk with Prabhupada, and he was debating. The devotees were taking the role of material scientists, and so he was making a point, and the devotees objected. But Prabhupada, a scientist would say, and Prabhupada, a scientist? I'm talking about reasonable people. So people have to be reasonable, you know. So you cannot give what you have in God. If we see people and activities, things here, they're there in the absolute truth. So this notion of just getting to the absolute truth by getting more and more abstract like that, that's a speculative notion. And we can understand that God has name, form, qualities, relationships. These things, this is the traditional list. Nama, rupa, guna, and Lila. They say, don't say karma, they say Lila on this list, yeah. In fact, that's the sequence in which Krishna is realized. First, his name. He's revealed to a devotee. First, his name is revealed, his form is revealed, his qualities revealed, his pastime is revealed. Names, form, qualities, pastimes. I always like to throw in relationships. That's really included in Lila. Just so everybody can understand, we're dealing with a complete... all those things are there in the absolute truth. They have to be. Not less than his creation and other things. So we can see that this effort, the speculative effort of the Mayavadis, try to understand God by eliminating these things. He's so subtle, he's so rarefied. These things aren't worthy of him, you know. A worthy conception of God. People try to form something that's worthwhile. Then they always think of something stupid, like old. Nobody wants to be old. Nobody enjoys it. Then he's pictured as an old man. Then rejected. And so on. That idea is rejected. Well, that's not a worthy idea. So they get this worthy idea, they end up with a great big nothing. No name, no form, no qualities, no pastimes, no relationships. Zip. You're going to talk about what is the greatest, the source of everything, and you've got something that's cognitively identical with nothing at all. Thank you very much for your contribution to the advancement of human civilization. You've just defined the greatest as nothing. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati calls this Mayavad idea a lax and indolent presentation of God. Lax and indolent. It's very, very limited idea. So the conception, the idea of Krishna is much greater. Name, form, qualities, relationships. But we say all these are spiritual. Because the denial of name, the denial of form, denial of qualities, it has a couple of things. First, it is based on just people's horrible experience in the material world and the rejection of that. I think we talked about that yesterday. You know, out of just sheer revulsion, and they want to just turn away from the material world, so they have an emotional reason to deny this thing. And there's also considerations of logic. The notion that definite form means limitation. Like this book, you see, it's a definite thing. Therefore, it's limited. It has a boundary. Here I am, I have form, I have a boundary. Here's the me and here's the not me. And so I'm defined by being limited, but the absolute truth by definition is unlimited. So therefore, as soon as you say form, you've implied limitation. As soon as you said this, is it not that? And so on. So this is another reasoning process by which they arrive at this Mayavadi idea. So this also has to be refuted, which can be very simple. Way to do it is to, and this will have to stop after this, but because you can go on for a long time on this, this really interesting topic. The way you do it is point out to people that, first of all, if there were no name, form, quality, relationship, that would also be a limitation. That would also be a limitation if he didn't have those things. So obviously, just to say they're absent doesn't secure God from limitation. I'm telling you, this is serious stuff. There's a very famous theologian named Paul Tillich who has an argument. It says God cannot be the supreme being among all beings, because if he is a being among many beings, that would limit him. Therefore, God is being itself, capital B, capital I. And these are like put forward by grown people and preached in pulpits, and you know, these are like, there's the argument. If he one being among many beings, that would limit him. Therefore, being itself. If you think about it for a minute, you'll understand that that also limits him, and that the actual truth is, he's both. You see what Tillich has done? He set up a false dichotomy. Either this or that. Who says it has to be either? He's the supreme being among all beings, and simultaneously, he's being itself. What do we mean when we say he's being itself? That as the source of all spiritual and material worlds, of all emanations, nothing is different from Krishna. And the ultimate feature, nothing is different from Krishna. Yet at the same time, Krishna is different from everything. This is Achincha Bheda Bheda Tattva. By that philosophy, we can understand how he can be the supreme being and at the same time being itself. You say he's a person, therefore he has senses, therefore he has an environment. Then he's limited. He's relative, he's not the absolute, because he's related to other things outside himself. Well, actually, everything outside himself that he's related to is himself in another form anyway. And Brahmasamhita says, Anantarupam, his form is endless. What does that mean? That also he has multiple forms. You think he's limited because he's Krishna and therefore blue? Well, he's Ramachandra and he's green. And he's on and on. There's many forms. And we don't know about them all either, by the way. We don't have a complete list. Even Krishna's busy finding them out. We're given to understand. His forms are endless, are unlimited forms, and another sense, Prabhupada says, is of an unlimited form is that each form has unlimited potencies. So now we're beginning to understand what kind of a being we're dealing with when we're dealing with the absolute truth, with Krishna. Not some little stupid, you know, dull shopkeeper's idea of what God would be like. This is real. And if people understand fully about Krishna, how he's a person, and what a person. Here's his biography, Srimad Bhagavatam. Not the complete biography. Of course, it's still going on. His life goes on endlessly. But even in the higher planets, they have many, many more volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam than are available here. So we have some partial biography, just so we can get to know a little bit about the Absolute Truth. This is a few of his adventures, few of his activities. So I think that we can show, through logic and argument, very reasonably that the Supreme Absolute Truth is a person. And we can show what kind of a person that Absolute Truth has to be. That he has to be simultaneously one and different from his manifestations, that he has to have endless forms, that he would have to so many things. Now, how do we know that that person is Krishna? By logic, you can't prove it. All we can say is, we understand the kind of a person the Absolute Truth would have to be. Here is our candidate. Who is yours? And I think you'll see that we have cornered the market on greatness. God is great, Prabhupada said. They know that, but they don't know how great He is. So we say, here's Krishna. If you know of anyone greater or anyone higher, if you have any higher conception, let us know. I don't think you'll see any takers anywhere. And in this way, people will have to acknowledge that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So any questions? Yeah.
Two questions. One, you spoke to the Upanishad. It's a prayer. It's quoted here in the 15th verse.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada said, it is spoken thus. But is there a prayer? A person is praying?
This is it's addressed. It doesn't say his name. Agni Naya Supatare Asman. It's addressed to Agni. Oh my Lord, powerful as the fire. You know, it's in the vocative case.
Do you know who the speaker is?
It's not given.
It's just. The other question. We hear the. I guess you would call it a philosophical term, absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have a conception of God, that often is defined or the supreme person. We talk about that, but how would you actually define the absolute truth?
Just like I said, janmadasyataha. That's the definition.
The word truth means something to me.
Oh, I see. We're using that as a handy tool. Param, supreme, and satyam is truth. Satya, that which is ultimately real. So you can say the supreme reality, the highest good. In classical, like Platonic philosophy, the ultimate source of all energies is defined as the good, the true, or the beautiful. Three different ways. And it's very interesting because good, true and beautiful, very nicely paralleled with Sat, Chit, and Ananda, that old triad, Sat, Chit, and Ananda, the three features, three qualities of Brahman. But so the truth in this case means that which is ultimately real, or absolute means. Doesn't depend upon anything else for its existence. Exists in its own state. Eko bhunam yo vidadati kamam. Is independent and everything else is dependent.
It's like the speculative philosophers use the niki-niki process.
Yeah.
They're searching for truth.
Yeah.
Is that kind of a term that originates from that search for truth? Is that...
Absolute truth became more popular in the 19th century. That notion was there. Otherwise, the most real being, that was a medieval term. The most real being, or the... And then the 19th century, with idealistic philosophy, Hegelian philosophy, they got into this notion of the absolute. And then they immediately, it was the 19th century also for the first time they came into contact with the Upanishads. Schopenhauer got a hold of the Upanishads, a Latin translation of a Persian translation, and read the Upanishads for the first time, and then immediately see, oh, this is the same, yeah, that's the absolute, that we all know about, which is impersonal oneness, and that's where they got started. So that's when the notion came about. He's using it, the absolute truth, he's using it. But so it's, you can't take, analyze that expression too diligently, because it's kind of a handy word to use. So when Prabhupada says absolute truth means the ultimate source of all energies, that's the definition you use, and not try to take apart the English.
It still seems a connotation of absolute truth or absolute reality or absolute good can be interpreted as impersonal. It can be interpreted as impersonal as opposed to the Supreme Personality of God.
Yeah, it can. It can.
So why does Prabhupada use it in a sense where it can be interpreted that?
Because sometimes for reasons of logical priority, you just want to talk about the ultimate source of all energies. That's the first step. Second step is discuss the more specific features. So the absolute truth exists in three features. I once wrote in a Prabhupada in a letter that I wanted to show scholars or somebody that the absolute truth was not impersonal but a person. And Prabhupada wrote me back. He was so precise. I was really impressed with this. He wrote me back. He says, actually, it is both. So it would be a mistake to leave out that side too, you know. So he said, very particular.
I'm curious about this word mundane language.
Uh-huh.
It's not at least wasn't a term that I was familiar with before. It seems like something that Prabhupada sarcastically came up with, or is that something that is it even exactly understandable?
Well, Wrangler is a brand of blue jeans. And a guy who was based on a guy who handles cows roughly, right? That's what a wrangler is. Of course, to wrangle means to argue. But it's really a kind of not a very fashionable term anymore. You know.
Probably old English.
Huh?
It's probably from Prabhupada's education.
Well, yeah, that's the, you know, a lot of Prabhupada's vocabulary is comes from. And sometimes very special meanings that people don't understand anymore. Like the famous statement, by hook or by crook. If you look up what it means, it doesn't have anything to do with being a crook in the sense of a criminal. As a hook is one kind of tool and a crook is another kind of tool. You know? So sometimes you have to be careful like that. And I have a dictionary, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary, which tells you how words were used down the centuries, so you can look back and see. Whenever there's something in Prabhupada I want to be precise about, I look for something that was current in England around 1890 or so, because that was how the kind of English that was being used in India at that time when he was educated. So... Yeah, Wrangler is, you know, like, it's not old English, but it's a little old-fashioned. People mostly understand it, but they don't use it much anymore. Mundane is still around, of course. Again, people don't even use mundane. They just mean ordinary, non-exciting, bland. You know, your household margarine or whatever is mundane. But, you may have to think of another word to talk to people with these things, you know. Well, but sometimes he says, you know, argumentative logicians. It's not a very current word.
Because we notice when new devotees begin preaching, when they adapt to the Krishna conscious environment philosophy, they use all these terms. They're going out there, you know, they're talking to 17-year-old kids.
Who have no idea what they're talking about. Right. I know. I've noticed that. Yeah, a lot. Yeah, you also have to remember, like when you preach to somebody, you have to remember that you have a very clear idea of what a soul is, for example. You come to Krishna consciousness, you know what a soul is. They have no idea. You know, if you say, you know, and they'll believe you say, you know, we're the soul, and they immediately think, yeah, I have a soul. You know, just the notion that I am a soul and have a body. They all think, even if they believe in the soul, they all think, I am a body and I have a soul. They think it's like some kind of, you know, ghostly organ. You know, like a kidney that will get transplanted on and on, only it's subtle. So what they really think is, I die and my soul lives. So what should I care? Since I'm going to die. About this, you know, subtle pancreas that goes on and on. That's what they think. You really have to understand that people on these things have very poor Here's another expression, fund of knowledge. They don't know anything about this stuff, and most of what they think they know is wrong. So it takes a lot of, just like when you use the word God, you know, what do people think? You know, what do people think when you say God? And people say to me, I don't believe in God, and I say, well, tell me what you describe your idea of God. And they describe it and say, well, I don't believe in that God either. That's always the case. Hardly always the case. It's like the famous Friedrich Nietzsche, who was the one who was, the first one to announce that God is dead, the big atheist. He said that he would be able to believe in a God who could dance. So here's an idea of God he had, you know, who was such a stiff, pompous ass that he could never, you know, relax and have a good time. Just like some, you know, Victorian guy with a big, formidable beard, always grumpy. You know, this is, of course, who wants to believe that? You know, of course, you don't want to accept that God. We don't either. And you think, well, here's Krishna. He dances, 16 years old. That's it. And now you're getting closer to someone who actually is all attractive. Most people's idea of God is of someone who is not all attractive. Therefore, it's not Krishna. Therefore, it's not God. We have to really find out what's going on sometimes. Yeah.
In regards to the Vaikuntha planets, and we were describing how the soul is the most subtle, at least in our material conditioned state. Sometimes it's described that the spiritual world, the Vaikunthas, are outside the covering of the universe. And I think you have to pass beyond the Viraj River.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time, it's described that the kingdom of God is in our one's heart.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we understand Vaikuntha planets being described in terms of material locations, geographical locations? How do you understand?
Yeah, the geography of reality is something that you really can't understand. So you can hang on with any particular ideas there. If it says that this is 1/4 of the creation, but the creation is unlimited. So what's 1/4 of something that's unlimited? You know, then it doesn't really compute in any kind of literal way. But it's given to us for our rough understanding. What we do is many of the things that we know, we just have to accept, understanding that we'll come to know what it means more fully later on. Even just that, Krishna is blue. Well, what is that blue? It's not a blue of this material world. It's a spiritual blue. It must have some relationship to this blue, otherwise we wouldn't be able to use the same word. It's not arbitrary that he's called blue. But still, it's another kind of blue. It's just, well, what is that? Well, you're just going to have to come and see. That's all. Then you'll understand. So we'll use the word. How do we know it's the right word? Because it comes from Shastra. That's how we know. Because those who have seen Krishna have used this word to describe him. And in fact, he is none different from those words that describe him. Chintamani prakara sadmasu kalpa viksha lakshavita. Those are the words. But don't actually think, when people say, oh, do you take that literally? I say, yeah, but I don't know what the literal meaning is. When my senses are fully spiritualized, then they'll be able to apprehend the literal meaning of those words. But certainly, those are the right words. I don't speculate about those words. Like the mundane speculators. Well, God is good, yes, but what does that mean? After all, here we only know good contrast with what is bad, but there is blue. Good absolute with no contrast to bad. So we can't really say that God is good, but he's something like good or similar to good. And all your language just dissolves and goes away. That's not our process. We have language that describes Krishna, and actually we'll be able to understand that language by using it, by hearing and chanting
becoming purified by it. So that's our process. Then we'll understand, as much as we need to anyway, we can understand that when Lord Brahma finally saw something of the real geography of creation, he begged Krishna to turn it off. And then he said, I see that everything is within you, and I'm within you. Everything was in you, and yet I'm here and you're over there. He couldn't handle it. So we can understand that some things are beyond our grasp. But as much as Krishna reveals to us, that we will accept. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.